This has been a really neat workshop. I've had a lot of fun here. I thought it was going to be one of the few token experimentalists, but that wasn't at all the case, and it's been a really interesting mix here. I've very much enjoyed it. So I'd like to tell you about some experiments that we've been working on over the last couple of years, and we've written up a little bit about our work in conference proceedings, but it turned out the problem ended up being a lot more complicated than what we anticipated originally. I'm essentially just repeating the experiment that Li Jing told us about, was it yesterday or the day before? Earlier this week. And we do it in a slightly different fashion. Instead of using, you're using rubidium or cesium, I forgot now.
One of those.
We're using a different alkali, and for reasons I'll try to explain a little bit later, so that we can get into the very high gain regime. So I really want to make this anomalous dispersion very, very large, and I want to make the gain very, very high, so that I have a hope of seeing large relative advancement of the pulse going through the vapor. And I'd just like to outline what we've been fighting with over the last 2 years in trying to do this experiment. Before I forget, I'd just like to mention I have a few articles I could share with you. Bob Boyd and I wrote a review article that just appeared in Progress in Optics last month on slow and fast light, and I can make additional copies for that if anyone would like it. I also have a preprint of a paper that we just submitted to Physical Review Letters right before I came out that I can share with you. And then there's some older papers of mine where I've been studying how a bichromatic field interacts with a two-level atom. So when I was a postdoc with Tom Mossberg, we were studying the effects of strong two-frequency fields driving atoms looking at resonance fluorescence spectrum. And the problem is pretty complicated. Based on what I've done with Tom, I should have known that this is going to be a complicated problem. And I was a little bit naive. So I'd like to just give a little overview and introduction of where we're heading, just to review what Li Jing was telling us earlier in the week. So this is straight from his Nature paper, but the ideas really date back earlier to. And so the idea is that instead of trying to use an absorbing line, if you use a gain doublet, so this curve here shows the gain profile, and this curve here shows the refractive index profile. If you choose the width and the spacing of these peaks just right, you can get a region where the anomalous dispersion is large, and you can really cancel the higher order dispersive effects if you choose your experimental parameters properly. And so the idea is that you want to take a pulse whose carrier frequency is right here in the center of the gain lines, and the spectrum is narrow in comparison to these peak separations, and hope that you'll see some interesting effects going on. In the experiment that Li Jing was telling us about, so let's see, it's 6, so that's cesium you're using. And, so this is the energy level diagram of the pertinent levels in cesium that Li Jing was using. And so the idea is that you take a strong laser field and shine it on these alkali atoms. But it's a two-frequency field, what I call a bichromatic field. And you tune close to a ground state to one of the first electronic excited states, so it strongly couples this bichromatic field to the atom. And you tune somewhat off resonance. And if you apply an optical pumping field to the atom so that you clean out the population from this state and transfer population into this state, then you can have a Raman scattering process where you annihilate photons from the pump field and add photons to the probe field. So this is the mechanism by which you can amplify a probe beam of light going through the system. Now, what Li Jing realizes is if you make this field bichromatic, then you'll create two gain peaks in the process. And this is what they saw when they launched a pulse through this cesium vapor. This is just the exact same data that we saw earlier in the week, and this is straight out of the Nature paper and out of our review article. So the solid line is the input pulse. This is intensity as a function of time. The dashed line is what they saw when you have the actual atoms there. So black line when there's vacuum, dashed line when you've got the anomalous dispersion there.
What's your 14 compound?
The what?
14 compound.
14?
We could count that.
The time axis, it should be 4, not 14.
Gee, I hope it didn't make it. I think this is straight off the out of the. I'll have to look in the review article. There's a slight chance that I, but it looks very lined up with that. I think I took it straight out of the Nature paper.
Ignore the 14, it's about right. It's about 3.7 microseconds was your pulse duration?
Yes, yeah, the pulse duration's about almost 4 microseconds. And when you go through and look at how much it's advanced, then you find that the group index for this case is negative, and it's around minus 300. So the group velocity is just equal to the speed of light in vacuum divided by the group index. So the speed of light is negative, and that means that the peak of the pulse has left the medium before it enters. But as you can see, the fractional pulse advancement is pretty small. In fact, if it's gone through a few photocopyings as it has here, it's a little bit hard to distinguish the output from the input. But it certainly was very measurable in the experiment, giving rise to this value for the measured group index. The other thing I'd like to bring to your attention for later is to take a careful look up at the peak of the pulse. This will be important for the results I'll show you later. You see that there's modulation on the top of that pulse. And if you go through and you measure the period between these oscillations and convert that into a frequency, that ends up being identical to the frequency difference between the two Raman pump beams that are driving the system. Okay. In one sense, you'd expect to have some modulation there eventually if you were to go to the high gain limit. The reason is that you've got these two gain lines that are sitting there. The spectrum, even though it's narrow, still has some tails that overlap with those gain lines. And so the spectrum of the output pulse, since this is a linear system, or should be a linear system, is just you multiply the transfer function for the system, which includes the gain and the refractive index, times the input pulse spectrum. So the output pulse spectrum is mainly going to be a Gaussian spectrum, but it's got some little peaks now that are out at the peak of the gain lines. And this is very much related to what Kurt Austin is saying. Any type of Taylor series expansion is going to get that wrong. What you're going to find is that when you do a Taylor series expansion, eventually you're going to get a term in the Taylor series expansion that's bigger than the preceding terms. And that gets worse and worse the larger and larger you make the bandwidth, or the higher and higher you make the gain, or the more and more you travel through the medium. They're all coupled to each other. They're all related to each other. So in the low gain limit in which Li Jing was working, there's a little bit of modulation there. And in fact, this is an averaged trace. And I'm going to be showing you differences between averaged and not averaged traces. It ends up it makes a huge difference in our case when we go to the very high gain limit. So in the low gain limit, you pretty much get the pulse that you put in. There's starting to be some hint that something interesting is going on there. And we find that even what I've told you, the story gets more complicated. So one thing that, again, just reiterating what I said at the beginning, what we've been focusing on is trying to obtain large pulse advancement. So let me define what I mean by pulse advancement. If I have a pulse, send it through a medium, and if it were vacuum, it would end up here. If I now send it through a medium that has anomalous dispersion, it gets advanced by a certain amount. I call the advancement time just the time between the peak with the anomalous dispersion to the peak in vacuum. And the relative pulse advancement, which is a dimensionless quantity, I just write as the ratio of the amount that you've advanced it to the pulse width. So it just tells you, relative to the pulse width, how much you've advanced it. Now, for practical applications that you might imagine for using this, you'd want the advancement large, and hopefully much larger than the pulse width, so you can really make something interesting from the device. So we've gone through to try to figure out how do you attempt, as a first pass, to optimize this pulse advancement. Well, the first thing that you want to do, and this is what Li Jing already has done, is that you want to try to cancel out the higher order dispersion first so you don't corrupt your pulse too much as it travels through the medium. And so the things that I can adjust experimentally is the spacing between these two gain peaks. I just change the frequency difference in my bichromatic field, so that's an easily adjustable parameter. And then the width of this gain resonance. And usually that's pretty much fixed by the experiment. In Li Jing's experiment, he's working down at fairly low powers and he had paraffin-coated cells, and so these line widths are fairly narrow. We take the other approach. We put in somewhat stronger laser beams. We don't use a paraffin-coated cell. And so we end up lifetime broadening the final state that the Raman transition is going to. So this line width tends to be a little bit broader in our case than in Li Jing's experiment. So that means we use shorter pulses. So the bandwidth of our whole system is a little bit broader than what his system was. And then just for later discussion, I'm using the symbol G sub zero to represent the intensity gain coefficient that corresponds to the peak. So if I were to take a continuous wave probe beam and measure the gain at this peak, then the intensity at the output would be E raised to the G naught times the length of the cell. Okay. Now, if you go into this condition like I've gone here, where I've chosen the separation to the line width just right so that this is as flat as possible, so I kill the third order dispersion term, then what you find is that the gain coefficient here at the center is roughly 30% of the peak gain.
What's as flat as possible? The bottom of your gain dip?
No. So. Yeah, so that's an interesting question that we can talk about. Since everything is very symmetric in the system, I'm thinking I'm going to put my pulse in here. If I do a Taylor series expansion about this point, the second derivative gives me of the refractive and complex refractive index profile gives me the that's the group velocity. Okay, so then the next derivative is only due to the absorptive part. And usually in most cases where you're thinking about transparent medium, everyone throws that out. Okay, you don't worry about it because you don't have that as an effect. But we'll see in the experimental data that this part, due to the frequency-dependent gain, does give rise to some interesting effects. And Li Jing has a preprint.
That where is drawing up your wings and structure.
Yes. Okay. And then the next derivative tells you about the curvature in the refractive index. That is, it gives you the group velocity dispersion. So what I've done is I've chosen these values so you set the group velocity dispersion to zero. Okay, so it's only higher orders dispersive effects that come in. Okay. So then the only other parameter you have left in order to come up with
the ratio of gamma to delta for that to happen.
Oh gosh. We can go and look at it. It's roughly, so this width to here, it's like a factor 2.5 or 2.7 or something like that. I don't remember right off the top of my head.
But Dan, you're saying that now the dispersion in the imaginary part comes in to lower order than the dispersion in the real part that you're trying to cancel.
Yes, so you might think that this would not necessarily be the optimum conditions experimentally. Yes, and we haven't played with that a lot. We have gone a little bit to this. We have gone and doubled or tripled the frequency splitting, and I'm still not sure where we are yet with that. We saw so many other problems that worrying about that was a minor issue in what we were concerned about. Okay, so the last thing that we have is choosing the pulse bandwidth. So the idea is that I'm going to take a pulse that's going to have probably some Gaussian shape. So I use an acousto-optic modulator and an arbitrary function generator to chop out a Gaussian pulse from a continuous wave laser beam. It has some finite spectral width, and I'm going to try to put the carrier frequency right here in the center. And okay, so you've got to take some guess as to how you want to pick that bandwidth. I think Michael was picking about a third or so of this splitting or so, seemed to give, at least in simulations, reasonable, tolerable levels of distortion. So if you put all that into the game, what you find is that the relative advancement takes on a very simple form. It's just 1/10 the gain path length. So you find out the size of the gain here on line center, multiplied by the length of your median, multiplied by 0.1, and that's the advancement that you might expect. Okay, you can argue with me that maybe we took too broad of a bandwidth, but if I narrow this up, well, that's just going to reduce it. So this is kind of a rough working estimate, kind of an upper bound of the amount of advancement that you'd get. So the bottom line is that you've got to increase the gain if you want to get larger advancement. Now, if I want to relate it to the gain here right at the carrier frequency, well, these two are related to each other by about a factor of 30%. So the advancement is roughly 0.03 times the gain path length right at the carrier frequency in between these two gain lines.
So in the previous experiment, it was an advancement of about 1%?
Yeah, that's the numbers here. So if I go to their data, G naught L is about 1.3. So then, if I use my little formula, I expect an advancement of about 13%. They observed about a 2% advancement, but they are using a factor of 2 times narrower bandwidth than what I've assumed in my rough arguments here. So I'm still off by a little bit. I don't fully understand that. It could be just I haven't gone through and figured out their bandwidth properly. But yes, this is, you use the amplitude gain coefficient, I use the intensity gain coefficient, so I've multiplied it by a factor of 2, so I've gone and translated your notation into my notation, that's all. So that's why there's a factor of 2 difference there.
That means we have room for improvement.
Yeah, or I'd want to carefully understand what your bandwidth was. I was trying to do this quick yesterday. So now the issue is when you start to turn up the gain, you've got to be careful. You go to a high gain system, which we want for increasing the advancement, and you're going to get some kind of competing effects. We certainly know that whenever you have an amplifier, there's quantum fluctuations that are added to the beam. You can't have a noiseless amplifier. So this is certainly going to be a problem. And if you really run the gain up too high, then you're going to get into the regime, what's called the ASC regime, where the quantum fluctuations at the input of your medium turn into a very large macroscopic field by the output. In fact, we can get into the regime where ASC is so strong that it actually depletes most of the energy from the input pump fields. So ASC is not a perturbation on the system, and potentially in our case. It can really go into extreme depletion. And the problem is that this takes your incident pump waves and turns them into new frequencies that are Stokes-shifted, Raman-Stokes-shifted. So that might be a bad thing. You're just going to have lots of light spraying out that has nothing to do with what your input pulse. Okay. And there's been several papers that have looked in the limit where quantum fluctuations are important, but they haven't looked at the limit where ASC is so important that it's really starting to have a major effect back on the system. This is still in kind of the weak field limit. And there's been very few experiments where people really have looked carefully at the quantum noise limit in this ASC regime where you have strong pump depletion. So the threshold for this process to really take off, or sometimes called the superfluorescence, I'm still having a hard time understanding whether I should call it ASC or superfluorescence when I've got continuous wave pump fields. But whatever you call it, roughly the threshold Boyd's book or others you can look at is when G naught L, this intensity gain coefficient, is roughly around 30. So just to normalize yourself, you take e to the 30 so that the ratio, I got that wrong, it's supposed to be output intensity to input intensity, should be about 10 to the 13. This is a really high gain limit, okay? In my lab, I can easily achieve e to the 15 and probably more. It just really starts to get hard to measure it because you put in a single photon probe beam and you're saturating the medium, basically. So you're really in the single photon nonlinear optics regime. So e to the 15 corresponds to a gain of 10 to the 6. So we easily, in the lab, get to an intensity gain of a millions. That is, if I take a continuous wave laser, tune it to the gain peak, the output is a million times stronger than the input. In that case, you'd expect an advancement of 1.5. So 1.5 times the pulse width is the most that you could advance things in my lab. So you get a little bit more, factor 2 more, if you go into this, what Boyd calls the threshold for ASC. So that seems to be about it. You're not going to do much more than one or two pulse widths just by this competing effect of amplified spontaneous emission. So the idea of advancing a pulse 100 times greater than its pulse width, you just forget it. Quantum fluctuations are going to totally dominate what comes out. Yes, given the assumptions I made. Well, sort of. If I've got that gain there, you don't need to put any, this competing effect doesn't assume anything about an input probe beam. So those gain lines are going to go super radiant on their own.
But it does assume something about the density of states there, so if you suppress it by some means.
So if you could suppress.
Kind of a suppression of the gain so that it goes to the null or zero.
But I claim if you do that, you're going to make the dispersion go away.
You put it in a PVG.
But a photonic crystal, maybe you could suppress spontaneous emission and that you could turn off the effect of ASE. Yeah?
Just a comment. We've run into the same problem with numeric noise, and since there's sort of an analog.
Sure.
FFT, you have a little bit of numeric noise.
You're talking a gains of 10 to the 13. There's very few computers that can handle that kind of exponential gain. Yeah, you have to be incredibly careful with that. So let me tell you a little bit about our experiments. So it's fairly similar. This will just be one schematic, and I'll have others. So we just take a single titanium doped sapphire laser. We happen to use potassium vapor. The reason that we use potassium is that the ground state splitting is small and of the order of the Doppler width. I've been doing a lot of work over the last 10 years in trying to make a two-photon laser that's based on Raman-type processes. And so we've learned how to optimize the Raman effect. And it turns out the scaling scales very rapidly with the ground state splitting. So you make the ground state splitting smaller, you win big time. So we use a potassium vapor that's about 20 centimeters long. And I've got some references to some of our older papers on two-photon lasers where we try to get large gain, Raman gain. The ground state splitting for potassium is around 460 megahertz, where for cesium it's about 10 gigahertz. So we just take a single laser and we just use smoke and mirrors to generate all the beams. So just acousto-optic modulators to generate the bichromatic field. And then we use another acousto-optic modulator to generate the probe field. So we can either make that a continuous wave field and scan it through the gain lines, or fix it in between the gain lines, and send in pulses. One nice advantage for the experiment is that when you work on the D1 line of potassium, it turns out you don't have to use circularly polarized fields. You can just send in a linearly polarized pump field. But when you do that, there's an interference in the matrix elements such that if you try to put in a beam that's parallel polarization for the probe, it sees no gain. The probe beam has to be orthogonally polarized to the pump waves, and in that case it sees large gains, just the way all the matrix elements or all the magnetic sublevels sum together. Experimentally, that's great. I use a polarizing beam splitter to combine the probe and the pump beam so that the probe is linear and orthogonally polarized to the pump fields. After I go through the vapor cell, I use another polarizer to reject the pump fields. So it's just the probe light that makes it to the fast detector. So it's a nice.
And how big is the beam? How many atoms are there per second light?
Let me see if I can get back. It's slow down. Okay, so the number density that we're running at is somewhere between 10 to the 12 and 10 to the 13 atoms cubic centimeter. The 1 over E radius, that is what most laser books call omega naught, is equal to about 450 microns. And the cell length is 20. So roughly the number of atoms that I calculated yesterday, and I got to make sure I remember it, the number of atoms in the interaction volume is roughly 10 to the 11 atoms.
At any time.
At any time. And the thermal speed is, for these alkalis, about a millimeter per microsecond. So in a microsecond, the atom flies through. Pardon?
Couple of hundred meters per second.
That's equivalent to a millimeter per microsecond, roughly. That's a little bit faster than what they actually are. It's a millimeter per microsecond.
When you compare with the experimental results and so on, do you average over the intensity range that width of beam implies that the atoms are subjected to?
No. we just doing...
Do you mean to that or what?
You mean to find intensities or powers or... I don't do any, I don't try to do any direct comparison because the, since it's in the linear regime, it shouldn't matter about the power. But there is the issue that our probe beam is roughly the same size as the pump beams. We slightly shape them to be somewhat different, but basically the probe beam is of the order of the pump beam. So there is an issue that the Raman gain does vary spatially. And we do see a little bit of reshaping of both the pump beams and the probe beam traveling through the medium.
What was the duration of your pulses?
We'll see. Okay. It's anywhere from around 150 nanoseconds up to about 800 nanoseconds.
So this business of atoms flying in and out of the site of your beam during the pulse wouldn't be as strong an effect here as...
At least if I'm in the shorter pulse regime. Yeah. Neither Lijing nor I use a buffer gas that would slow down the diffusion of atoms through there. That's something we're thinking of doing now.
What about the optical pumping scheme? What did you mean?
Let me explain that. So this is either a bane or a trick, depending on how you look at it, that we discovered when we're starting to work this. You don't have to use a separate optical pumping beam, in that the Raman pump waves have both the action of doing the optical pumping and then subsequently Raman scattering from the optically pumped ground state. So the idea is that when you shine a strong wave, so this is a schematic diagram, we're sending in two strong pump waves, we bring in an orthogonally polarized probe wave into the vapor cell. The strong pump wave interacts both with the F equal 1 to the F equal 1 and F equal 2 excited states of potassium, and it interacts from the F equal 2 to these. So it's not a true three-level system like everyone likes to treat in theory. The pump wave interacts with both transitions, and that may be causing us potentially some problems in the experiment. So what happens is that we tune a little bit to the blue side of resonance. You're more on resonance with the F equals 1 to the excited state. You preferentially remove population from this state, throw it into the excited state, and then it relaxes back down into here. So we're constantly optically pumping the atoms. And this is more of an effect when the ground state splitting is small. You go to cesium where the ground state splitting is huge, and this effect I'm talking about, it almost vanishes because of that effect. Now that you've optically pumped the atoms into the state, these strong pump waves then can then undergo Raman-type processes and going from F equals 2 to the F equal 1 state, if I were to put a probe beam in here or here. Now, these two frequencies are different from the pump wave by just the ground state splitting, which is around 460 megahertz for our experiment. And then this frequency splitting is what separates the gain lines. In some of the experiments, we've had this set around 25 megahertz, and others, we've had it set around 10. So this is the Raman process that we would hope is the only thing that's going on. And that I would then launch a probe pulse that's in between these two frequencies here. That is from here to here, and it should experience this anomalous dispersion. And I apologize.
So what was the bandwidth of your pump pulse?
We'll get to that. We vary it.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Got to figure out how to get this to load without it running the next. Let me just get out of this for a second. The one data slide that I wanted to show you, my student Michael likes using Linux. I only had it in PDF version here, and I couldn't figure out how to get it into PowerPoint. So I've just got it as a PDF file. Pardon the delay here. Okay, so this is a partial transmission spectra of a continuous wave probe beam going through the vapor cell. The numbers here don't have much meaning for what we're doing here, except zero. No, I guess it does have meaning the way you said it. Zero is a frequency that we, in principle, should be injecting the carrier frequency into the beam. These two peaks here, and I'll explain what the different color lines mean in a second. These two peaks here are the Raman gain peaks that we're trying to use, and it should be right in between here that we have large anomalous dispersion. Okay. I'm only showing you a limited part of the spectrum because our acoustic optic modulators only can tune so far. But we've got a couple different cases. If we just put in one of the pump fields, so this is the one that's slightly lower frequency, you see a single Raman gain peak and there's nothing else in the spectrum, absolutely flat. We'll put in the blue, slightly higher energy Raman pump beam, and we see a single peak over here where we expect it. We then put in both of them, so now I'm really putting in the bichromatic field, and the gain goes up by about a factor of 2 at each one of these peaks. But what's really bothersome and has been driving us crazy, there's another huge peak sitting over here to the low frequency side. And I also know there's another one to the high frequency side, we just didn't catch it in the scan. Another one, and another one. And so the trouble is that in order to avoid Doppler broadening in these Raman gain features, these are all very narrow, of the order of a couple megahertz, and yet we're working with a Doppler broadened vapor cell, our probe and our pump waves are all co-propagating. And so we should have been wary that the susceptibility is not just these two gain lines. The susceptibility also contains the possibility of coupling input fields to quantum noise fields.
Yeah, and this is a little bit different from what we saw.
Yeah, this is in the high gain limit. Absolutely.
In our case, if you put in only one color, you get twice the size of the gain coefficient compared to that of that color. In other words, as if they're competing for the same atoms to produce gain in either peak.
Yeah.
So the overall gain of the peak will drop to less of about half of the single peak.
And we
first almost doubled. I don't see any reason why.
Oh, I can give lots of reasons why. Because first, we're optically pumping with the same beams. So you add in more power, you optically pump more. Okay? Because it's the same pump beams that are optically pumping the atom to give you the Raman inversion. And when you go to the high gain limit, where multi-wave mixing processes might be important, then you have additional contributions to the gain that you don't have in the low gain limit. And so you would expect that these would start to become important. So now there's multiple peaks. Now, the reason that these look so sharp and you're not seeing the same kind of profile that I showed before is that all the plots I've been showing before is the actual gain coefficient. You have to exponentiate that to figure out what the transmission through the vapor cell is. So you take e to the 15, and here the gain is roughly 3 million or something like that at this peak here. So we're roughly at e to the 15 at this gain peak here. And so even though this is only down by 30%, the gain coefficient, when you exponentiate that, it's a huge, huge drop. So you really just get these sharp things coming up out of nowhere. The other thing, and that we've gone and put this baseline at zero, but we've artificially adjusted that. There's a heck of a lot of light coming out of the vapor cell when we put no probe in there, when we're in this really high gain limit.
The two pump waves that are coming from the same, they're phase coherent.
They're phase coherent, but there is a slight jitter between them because they do travel separate paths before they recombine them. But that jitter is fairly slow.
Did you try to artificially scramble the phase between them together?
Not yet.
Michael, you can never do that. If you do that, then you broaden.
You phase modulate them and you broaden the spectrum of each one of those.
Maybe it's not possible to just, you just scramble the difference phase between the two, not the...
Yeah, but one of them, that's a little hard to do. But
are you saying that these sideband peaks are strong enough that their tails of the absorption curve are coming into the place where you care about and changing significantly?
No.
What you need?
No. It's
they're far enough what the, maybe that you don't care.
But you got to first figure out why the heck are they there. Yeah. Okay, so that's what we've spent a year and a half trying to go through in detail.
Okay.
And it turns out the real thing that we were fighting with is that any photons that you seed into the system, the gain is so high that a few photons of the wrong frequency kill you. And so we've really had to trace through. You get multiple reflections in the AOs that then create slightly different frequencies. You go through and you estimate how many photons you're throwing in and from those, and it's like one or two. So we have to go out and buy special AOs to really get rid of the possibility of seeding any other frequencies into the thing. This gain is just through the roof, so you have to really be careful about what photons you throw around.
Okay. do you see also gain in the vector direction?
We haven't tried. I would expect that that is Doppler broadened, but
well, I mean, that because this is a typical system that you would see rather than the enhanced foliage of music.
Yes.
And so if you have a back, the back part of the cell, not it will reflect, of course.
Yes, we've worked very hard to make sure that that's not an issue. We tilt the cell. I've studied counterwave instabilities for my PhD thesis, so I'm a little bit aware of those. So we tried to avoid that. Now, so let me go on to show some experimental results. This data was collected maybe a year and a half ago, and it was, you know, we were trying to get ready for a conference. We wanted to get some talks about this. And we tried launching pulses in here whose center frequencies was right in between the two main gain lines. Every time we did that, the pulse is completely splattered. And so we were scrambling. It's like, oh, we got a talk coming up. What are we going to do? So what we found is if we want to put our carrier frequency over here, then we saw some interesting results. So this is...
Can I go back 1 second?
Yeah.
Did you say that there's a large background from ASE?
Well, I'll try to tell you it's not just ASE. It's everything going on. It's ASE. It's for mixing. It's everything you can think of. That's going on simultaneously. Again, you go to the high gain, and every competing effect that you can dream up is going to be a problem. I got to fight with Windows again.
What is the probability?
We vary it. For that plot there where we actually measured the gain, we were probably putting in about a picowatt. So we were putting in just about 1,000 photons per 100 nanoseconds or so.
Picowatt is a million photons per second.
Yeah, but I said per 100 nanoseconds or so, because those are the types of pulses that we're going to be launching in, are 100, 200 nanosecond long pulses. So just to summarize, we get unexpected gain peaks. We saw lots of light spraying out of the cell. When we try to inject a pulse in at the standard carrier frequency, we just saw severe distortion, which might be okay, but we didn't see what we wanted. So we went over to this non-standard carrier frequency in between this extra new unexpected gain peak and one of the main Raman gain peaks. And this is what we saw. And I haven't published any of these results. The reason is that we didn't know what the heck was going on, so I wasn't willing to publish what we were seeing. So we've gone and renormalized things, so everything is on the same scale. The black curve is what happens when we tune the lasers far off resonance and the pulses is traveling through vacuum. Time on this axis, intensity on this axis. We then launch in the pulse, and this is what we see coming out. So we do see that it's advanced. It's advanced substantially. The gain coefficient, GL, on the gain line is roughly around 10 for this experiment. But again, we weren't at the standard carrier frequency.
How much renormalizing did you need to do?
16, roughly. Okay. So the gain at where the carrier frequency was located was roughly around 16.
Choose a flat top sort of pulse for a reason?
It was supposed to be Gaussian, but there's a little bit of nonlinearity in the AO, and we've learned how to correct that, but it just wasn't quite as good as we wanted it at this time. Oh, it's pretty close to Gaussian. It's not not that bad.
What's the advantage of having true Gaussian?
Talk to Li Jing. He likes to...
Gaussian is the delta mu, but delta omega times delta t is the minimum.
Oh, sure.
So you can have small bandwidth, and yet, at the same time, the maximum possible relative
amounts. It's right at the transform limit. That's exactly what people always count. So the if I just look at how much the peak is advanced, if I take the peak here and I take the peak here, the advancement is 130 nanoseconds. This input pulse width is around 185 nanoseconds. So relative advancement we get is about 0.7. And the number of photons in this particular experiment that we sent in at the input was around 80,000. So at the output, it was around 16 times greater than that. And again, the number of atoms that are in the volume on average is around 10 to the 11 to 10 to the 12 atoms in the volume. So I should back up. Okay, so there's some ringing on here. I don't want to necessarily say that that's the case, but when you start to do simulations of these things, this is pretty common once you start to go to the high gain limit. I think this ringing is the what happens to the precursors when you go to a gain medium, is my rough guess. I haven't done anything to show anything about that, but it's not necessarily at the front end. I think the precursors may end up at the back end of the pulse.
For a short pulse, the Brillouin precursor, for example, is at the back end of the pulse.
Okay. But once you go to the gain median, that also helps to reverse things, too. The other thing is that there's pulse compression. The pulse is, this central peak is narrower than the input. And again, we pointed out that there's this frequency-dependent absorption.
But is the frequency, the beat frequency, consistent with this precursor interpretation?
I don't know. I haven't gone through to analyze it. Because there's, let me show you more. Okay. Again, this is an averaged result. I've taken many, many shots and averaged them together.
Are you sure there's no gain saturation?
I can't absolutely rule that out. We've worked really hard to make sure that we're not there. Again, it's so high gain that you put in a few photons and you can get into saturation. The gain isn't quite as high as we usually operate, and the reason we've lowered it is to try to prevent pulse distortion and to try to get away from that fact that a single input photon can saturate the medium. So, but I can't absolutely guarantee it. You know, we try to extrapolate back and see if we're really at the non-saturated limit. Okay, some people after the Li Jing's paper came out were claiming that just an amplifier can create pulse advancement, and Basov predicted that years ago, but that's in a saturated amplifier. So just to demonstrate, the same thing that Li Jing did, is that we took our pulse and put it to the gain peak, Raman gain peak, and we're not in optimum conditions. We didn't do anything to the input pulse. So the input pulse is too broad of a bandwidth to be doing this, but we did it anyhow. And it's stretched, as you'd expect, and it's delayed. So gain by itself can't explain the advancement that we're seeing. You really have to be thinking about the dispersive properties. I'll try to go a little bit faster here.
It seems like you could rule it out by sending two identical pulses in rapidly, one after the other, and see that they both get the same kind of amplification and so on.
That's essentially what we've done. I don't want two in there at the same time because
one coming and another one coming.
Yeah, that's essentially what we've done. This experiment's stable enough that we can go and sit over and turn the dials and do that.
But I mean, do it in rapid succession where you're...
I did it in rapid. Rapid depends on how stable your experiment is. We can sit there for hours and it's stable, so I don't see that that's an issue.
I'm talking about the pump time. Right? You're exciting your medium.
It's always being excited continuously.
Right, but there's still some kind of amount of time you need to wait if say you completely saturate.
But we're working in the regime where we're not saturating at all.
Well, I was saying this is a test.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, we launch trains of pulses in there. From pulse to pulse, they're identical.
And they're close together, just, you know, followed by a microwave.
No, we haven't done that. No, but not too much longer than that. Okay. Just a few microseconds later. Okay, so... forget about, turn off all the averaging. This is what we see coming out. This is again why we didn't publish our results. That average, you see that nice envelope, it seems consistent sort of with what you expect of the theory, and then this is a single shot result. So the time, if I figure out this period between these oscillations, that's exactly equal to 1 over the frequency splitting between these two gain lines, okay? And it jitters. From shot to shot, there's large jitter in where these spikes come. And it depends on the relative timing of when we actually launch the pulse in comparison to the beat note between the two pump waves that are there.
Again, this is with the carrier frequency.
Yes, this is still with the carrier frequency off on the weird side.
It's even worse if you're in the normal place.
But we've turned the gain down. I'm overstaying my welcome here. I should go a little bit quicker. We do have data where we've collected at the right place where we've turned the gain down. We still see similar things. Okay, so just to quickly, Peter, what should we do about time?
About 5 minutes late, so you have about 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to go through this. So this is just explaining what's in our preprint. So now what we do is we turn off the probe pulse. We know that something really weird is going on. The multi-wave mixing processes that Michael's already pointed out are probably taking effect. It could be ASC. It could be Faraday, nonlinear Faraday rotation. It could be a bunch of things that can start to come when you go into these really extreme cases. So what we've done is block the pump. The probe beam. We now have the bichromatic field coming in. Remember, it's linearly polarized. We put a polarizer here to block the pump wave. If there's nothing weird going on, no light should come out onto our detector. So what we've got to plot here is the amount of power that's leaking out through this detector as a function of the input power of the bichromatic field. It is fairly low, and then boom, there's an exponential growth that eventually levels off.
So this is the orthogonal
polarization. In the orthogonal polarization. So this is light that's being either Faraday rotated, being generated by ASC, or generated by four-wave mixing, or you come up with 20 other things that possibly could be going on here.
So this is a phase transition?
I wouldn't call it, well, I don't know. I haven't gone and looked at the statistics of it. But a if it was really ASC-type process, I wouldn't say that there's ever a phase transition. There's just exponential growth of the input quantum fluctuations. On a linear scale, it looks like it's a phase transition. But any exponential is going to do that. To really verify whether or not there is a phase transition, I'd really have to look at the quantum statistics of light that's coming out below and above that point. And we haven't done that yet. But note the numbers here. We are putting in 30 milliwatts, and we're getting out 5. This is not a small effect. In fact, a lot of the pump light is being absorbed and scattered by the atoms. So the total amount of light coming out is maybe, I think it was around 15 milliwatts. And so we're putting a heck of a lot of light into a state of polarization that shouldn't be there at all. And so what I'm going to show you, demonstrate, is that it's not Faraday rotation. It's just not the input light undergoing a rotation. So what we did is put an optical spectrum analyzer here after the polarizer. So we're only looking at the state of polarization that shouldn't be generated. And we see, this is on a gigahertz scale, and we see light coming out all over lots of different frequencies. The input frequencies are two delta functions here near the origin. Again, we're putting in linearly polarized beams. The polarizer then blocks them, so you shouldn't see the input light. So that is suppressed, but there's still a little bit that's leaking through. We see a heck of a lot of light coming out here. This is one ground state shift. This is where you would expect Raman scattering to take place. But it's enormously broad. Each one of these sharp peaks in here are really sharp peaks. The space in between those is equal to the pump beam frequency difference. We see light all the way out here. We're seeing multiple Raman scattering events so that we're going out, you know, they're 1.5, roughly 3 gigahertz bandwidth, we see substantial light coming in. So we put something where the frequency difference is 25 megahertz, and out comes 3 gigahertz worth of light.
Is this related to these things which Alex Zavalov and
Steve very much so. Very much so. They insist that you. It's too bad we're not overlapping. I've shown them this work before. They insist that you put the frequency difference at the ground state splitting, whereas we haven't done that. We haven't found a strong resonance when you do that. Pretty much, you put in whatever frequency difference you want, and this takes off.
They insist that the two.
They want to have the two strong fields differ by the Stokes shifts, and we don't see that strong resonance. I think I can explain why. If you take the frequency difference very large, you're losing enhancement from the electronic excited state in our experiment. Okay, the reason why things are probably limited to a 3 gigahertz bandwidth in this previous, Windows drives me crazy sometimes. This width is probably just related to how you're just getting further and further away from the electronic state, so you're just not resonantly enhancing that process. And everything that Sokoloff and Harris have been assuming, the electronic states are very, very far away. So they're very off-resonant from any one-photon transitions, whereas we're using that to really drop the powers down to what we need so that you can use really low powers. Okay, so now instead of an optical spectrum analyzer, we put a high-speed detector here and then put that into an electronic spectrum analyzer. And on a coarse scale, this is what we see. So this is the power spectrum as a function of frequency. And this goes out to 2.5 gigahertz. So you see a huge comb of frequencies, so roughly 100 or 200 harmonics of the input frequency. And now if we zoom in on this, so we look, so this here is one ground state splitting, this is two ground state splittings, three ground state, four, five, so on and so forth. And then if I zoom in on the spectrum around 460 megahertz, this is what we see. There are multiple peaks that are showing up in here. And some of these are Raman shifted, and some are just multiples of the pump field. So the pump field is undergoing wave mixing processes and generating multiple harmonics. Some of that's getting Raman shifted and generating multiple peaks. And we've been able to go through and identify each one of the peaks as far as how it appears in a wave mixing type process. The other thing that's very different from what Sokoloff and Harris predicts is that the resolution bandwidth of our spectrum analyzer is quite narrow in this plot. And what we see is that the fluctuations never go down to the electronic floor of the spectrum analyzer. Everything that Sokoloff and Harris predicts are all essentially delta functions. And so you'd expect that in between each one of these, it would go down to the noise floor. We never see a quiet region. In fact, the quantum noise limit for the particular power we're putting on the detector is at roughly at minus 90 dB. So we're thousands of times over the standard quantum limit. And we don't understand this. Have a few ideas. Now, if we just look at the same thing in the time domain to see whether all these frequencies are really phased coherently, they are. Again, this is the power in the orthogonal polarization as a function of time. If we look on a slow time scale, which we have here, we see some peaks in the intensity that are spaced by 1 over the frequency difference of the pump waves. Again, this is a heck of a lot of power. We're converting 30% or so of the output light into this new state of polarization. If we zoom in on this, we see there's a bunch of oscillations in here. This is 500 picoseconds, which is right at the resolution of our oscilloscope, right at the analog bandwidth. So we're putting in two continuous wave fields, and we're generating picosecond pulses coming out. Now, these look fairly irregular, and if you look from time series to time series, they look irregular. I'm wondering if this is a manifestation of chaos. So we've gone through and used some of the standard nonlinear dynamics analysis techniques for trying to see whether this is noise or chaos. Unfortunately, the number of vertical bits of resolution that we have with our fast oscilloscope aren't enough to tell us. So the analysis routines came back with ambiguous results. So we don't know whether it's chaotic or not. The very broad spectrum suggests that it is. Okay. Just to be a little bit more specific about the types of wave mixing processes that can occur, I've tried to sketch some little diagrams where the different colors represent the two pump waves, so the different types of things that can go on. There's just the standard Stokes Raman process. That gives rise, would allow you to expect a peak, two narrow peaks here. But now I can also have Stokes, anti-Stokes coupling. So I take the same pump photon, couple a one Stokes and an anti-Stokes. That would give rise to the peak that's over here. We then have other processes that involve multiple pump beams. I can take one photon from one of the pumps, another photon from another pump, another photon from the previous pump, and then generate something that's very close to the pump beam frequencies. That's why you start to see a spectral broadening near the pump frequency. So this is just a phase match polarized mixing process. And there's different time orderings that you can use for that. You can then also involve three pump photons and then generate a Raman. But that's not at the normal Raman frequency. It's shifted over by the pump frequency difference. And all these can happen over and over and over again. So it's just a very efficient mechanism for taking any frequencies and translating them everywhere into the spectrum.
So what is delta on the scale here?
It's these little wiggles that you can see, the little spikes.
Those little wiggles are
yes. We just have enough resolution to barely see them. I think if it's right at the boundary of the limit of our optical spectrum analyzer. So they are smeared out a little bit. But those little wiggles really are real, and they do correspond to that. Okay, so I'll just show one other piece of data and then I'll stop. So what we did is, now that we know this instable is here, let's try to avoid it. Either we turn down the pump beam and work here so that we're right below the threshold for the instability, or we keep the power high and just tune further off resonance, which also kills the gain. So one or the other, we've done both. We don't see much of a difference. Let me just jump to the punchline. Okay, so this is a case where we launched in a fairly long pulse. The other ones I don't have time to show you is when we put in shorter pulses and things still look messy. But this is the case where we're putting in now an 800 nanosecond pulse, and we've gone and taken the frequency difference between our two pump waves and narrowed them up a little bit. We've gotten better. We know how to make the gain a little bit narrower. And we're thinking this is about where we should be sitting. So the dots here are the input pulse, and the solid line is the output pulse. So certainly the leading edge is advanced substantially, but the pulse is also stretched by a little bit. And again, I think that's an indication that, I don't know what. We just collected this data Thursday before I got on the plane, so I don't want to say too much more about why it would possibly be stretched. But this is in a regime where we think we're below the instability threshold, and that we're putting in small enough power, but we still have the gain in a moderate range where we still should see substantial pulse advancement. But now, if I go and look on single shot, so now what I'm doing is, this is just the probe pulse now. This is average probe pulse, and this is single shot probe pulse. We still have 100% modulation in the intensity of the pulse traveling through the medium. And let's see, what else do I want to say about this? Sorry. The thing is, these are not all that short. They're awfully darn close to being sinusoidal. So we're not, it's not like that previous data where they were really short and at the limit of our detector. So at least things aren't as crazy as they might be. And if we go through and put in all our numbers and do some simulations of what we'd expect about the advancement that we're seeing with this average pulse shape. We really don't expect the pulse broadening that we were seeing, and we certainly don't expect this fast modulation.
That's 1 over delta?
Yes, yes, exactly at 1 over delta. So since we're supposed to be undulationists, why are these other undulations there that I don't like? So we're below the threshold for instability for just the pump waves and quantum noise being blown into the system. But the fact is, as soon as you throw in a pulse, you're adding photons into the system. And so I'm wondering, maybe the probe itself is lowering the threshold for the instability and seeding the whole thing. We're not generating a completely broadband spectrum, but Michael right now, while I'm here, is trying to measure the spectrum of the light that's going through. Actually, we don't even have to send in a pulse. We just send in a continuous wave beam. We see oscillations in the beam. It could be a nonlinear Faraday rotation, too. We've got to see where the light is that's coming out as far as
it could be the special pumping scheme.
It could be the special pumping scheme that we're using.
Because your pump is so much stronger now compared to our.
No, we're actually, I think, at lower intensity than you. We've turned down the power. No, the power's higher, but we're very far off resonance. So the equivalent intensities, if I were to try to normalize things based on the tuning that we're at,
I meant your line.
Yes.
Many milliwatts, tens of milliwatts.
Yeah, tens right
now.
In our
case, it's only 100 megawatts.
But we're very, very far off resonance. Much further away from resonance than you were. So it's equivalently a weaker beam. In fact,
some kind of a modulation or undulation of the atomic.
That's a possibility. And we're going to look into that. Yeah, that's certain. If we were to add a buffer gas, that would help. So I'm done. So we've tried to go through and investigate fast light in the high gain region. We've shown that four wave mixing processes can impose a severe limit to large pulse advancement. In fact, the gain where this sets in, it's like e to the 10, whereas the threshold for ASC, you'd expect e to the 30. And so this is much, much more important than amplified quantum fluctuations. It's quantum fluctuations seeding a parametric instability that occurs at a vastly lower threshold than just amplified spontaneous emission. So we need to suppress the instability to achieve large pulse advancement. And then even in the moderate gain regime, we're seeing something that we don't understand. But again, we just collected these experimental results on Thursday, but there's a chance that the probe pulse just throws you over the threshold for the instability. Now, the way to suppress it, Li Jing's pointed out that you could use two vapor cells in parallel, where you pump one vapor cell with one pump beam and the second vapor cell with a second pump beam, and we haven't tried that experimentally yet. I'm worried the ASC from one cell, though, will feed into the other and kill you. The other thing that you can do is use an orthogonal pump probe scheme, let's say using cold atoms like Lena Howe's been doing for slow light. Once they're orthogonal, you suppress all these wave mixing instabilities because you can't phase match the interaction. So, thank you.